This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. American history, particularly the nation's birth, is filled with men of charisma, charm, and, in the case of George Washington, height, if not teeth. Founding Father John Adams possessed a little less of all three than several of his peers, which he more than made up for in intellect and patriotism. He stands at the center of Trumbull's famous painting of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. It hangs in the Capitol, and it's likely that moment would never have happened if it were not for his efforts. After a difficult presidency, Adams was chronically underappreciated, but David McCullough's critically acclaimed biography began a reconsideration, and that springs gloriously to life in an HBO miniseries, John Adams, which stars Paul Giamatti as the stubborn, difficult, and virtuous second president, and Laura Linney as his wife and chief advisor. The seventh and final chapter airs on Sunday, though it will live on in repeats, on demand, and eventually on DVD. We'll talk with the director, Tom Hooper, as well as David McCullough today. Later in the hour, your letters and a moon over Birmingham, Alabama. But first, the HBO miniseries, John Adams. If you've been watching it, and if you have questions about the production or about the history, our number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And you can join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Tom Hooper is the director of the series, and he joins us today from the BBC studios at Western House in London. Thanks very much for being with us.
Absolute pleasure.
And there's a lot of drama in the history itself, but I notice that you've chosen to take many of the big events, the Boston Massacre, the Tea Party, much of the Revolution itself, off camera. It's an intimate portrayal, history almost as conversation.
Well, we needed to organize the huge wealth of narrative material in a way that made it pertinent and emotional to John and Abigail. And early on in the development of the scripts, I felt that we should stick exclusively to John and Abigail's point of view in the telling of the story. I mean, one early version of the script, we also told Jefferson's story as an independent strand, and it quickly became apparent that it was very hard to do justice to, you know, John and Abigail and Jefferson, and that John and Abigail should be our focus. And in a funny way, in a slight mirroring of David's process with the novel, where David, I think, started writing about Adams and Jefferson and got drawn to Adams and Abigail, I felt that same pull to absolutely concentrate, you know, the narrative power in the hands of those two. And you know, in some ways, it allows you to see the personal impact of the war in slightly surprising, unusual ways, particularly the impact it has on Abigail and the children. And, you know, and you have that very strong sense that she's left in the second episode on the doorstep of the front line, while actually Adams is, you know, many miles away in a much more secure position. And you get a sense, the sense of the danger of the war comes through Abigail at that stage.
Mm. There is also this is a triumph of casting. I mean, the actors. You think of Paul Giamatti, and he will forever, I think, be John Adams after this. Laura Linney as well animates Abigail Adams. David Morris, particularly as George Washington, just seems to be brilliant.
I was talking to Laura, and she was saying she's never been stopped so many times on the street as you know, because of her portrayal of Abigail. So I think you're right.
There's also, you made some interesting choices on how to shoot this picture, odd angles and so forth. You rarely see an image of Adams or Abigail Adams in the center of a frame.
I wanted to get away absolutely from a what I'd term a sort of classical romanticism in the way that I shot the film. I felt that the toughest and most important job I had as a director was to recapture a sense of the true uncertainty of outcome if you were John or Abigail, any of those characters at the time. That, you know, and it's hard to imagine that when we sit with American independence as such an obvious fact in all our lives, that there was a time when its future was so provisional and uncertain. And, you know, what I felt I needed to pull off, particularly in the second film, was a sense that the future was not foretold, it was not preordained, and there's something about the language of romantic cinematography, which is about looking back at the past with rose-tinted spectacles, knowing already that these people are heroes. I wanted to get back to a sense when we didn't know who the heroes were even going to be. And, you know, the way we introduce characters like Jefferson and Washington, I consciously tried to make their introductions very low-key so that they didn't come with a big announcement of these are the important characters of history. Yeah. So the use of handheld and the kind of edgy style where there's a tremendous shifting of points of view of the way it's shot, I wanted to underline the sense of the deep uncertainty and the risk that the characters were taking. And when we go, when we then go to Europe, we find that we return to kind of dolly mounted cameras and a much more classical style of photography, because that kind of represents the old order, which is far more settled.
We're speaking with Tom Hooper, the director of HBO's miniseries John Adams, which concludes this weekend. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. Let's talk with Jonelle. Jonelle calling us from Penn Valley in California.
Yes, thank you so much. I love the program, the music. Abigail is wonderful. I have one quickie. Why in the White House was there smoke billowing through the house? I understand that the plaster needed to be dried, but did that really help?
that was a detail, that David McCullough gave me, and I gather it does, but I wouldn't necessarily want to suggest it to every American with wet plaster in their home.
Those scenes of that half-built White House are extraordinary. Did you half-build a White House?
We did, and we found this area of clear-cut land in Richmond, Virginia, just outside Richmond, Virginia. I was constantly searching when I was directing it for images that would subvert our sense of expected history, and the way David described the White House in the book and the research we did led us to this very sort of startling image. And because you'd expect it to be a very kind of patriotic moment, or a moment that reinforced a romantic notion of the new capital, but it was a very, very different image.
Jonelle, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you. I hope he does more historical portraits. It's just wonderful.
Thank you so much.
Let me ask you a question about the dialogue. How much of what they say was lifted from the speeches of the various men and the letters between John and Abigail?
A huge amount, but I think most of all, where we have best records is in Congress or in public political meetings. I mean, we know. I believe in Congress they didn't actually take minutes of everything that was said. But I mean, for example, Dickinson's wonderful speech, the skiff made of paper speech. He wrote that speech down, and we have those notes, and so we can be pretty clear. We're very close to what was said. I think the areas where one has to invent most is in the most intimate scenes, when if you've got John and Abigail lying in the bed, because not surprisingly, no records were kept of those. But if I'm wrong, please could someone tell me?
Mm-hmm. Here's a scene, for example, John Adams again played by Paul Giamatti, in an address to his fellow Bostonians before leaving as a Massachusetts delegate to the First Continental Congress in Philadelphia.
Liberty is not built on the doctrine that a few nobles have a right to inherit the earth. No! No! It stands on this principle that the meanest and lowest of the people are, by the unalterable, indefeasible laws of God and nature, as well entitled to the benefit of the air to breathe, light to see, food to eat, and clothes to wear as the nobles or the king. That is liberty. And liberty will reign in America.
Again, an excerpt from the HBO miniseries John Adams. Was that taken verbatim? And if not, do you tremble at the idea of putting words in John Adams' mouth?
There was definitely good source material for that speech, and I think what he's touching on there is this extraordinary moment in the 18th century where people began to say, is it really true that God has ordained, you know, one man to reign over all men, and another class of men below that man to reign in their stead. In other words, is it really God who has decided that there should be a king and an aristocracy, or, you know, are all people created equal? And it's hard to understand now, you know, how radical and how significant that thought was, because it was a time when monarchy was the absolute dominant mode of power across the world. And it's incredibly exciting sort of recapturing this moment, you know, this heady moment of change in terms of people's understanding of their role in the world. I mean, of course, the only problem with it was that those freedoms didn't apply to all people in American society. They applied to white men. And the fallout from the lack of the extension of that idea to everyone in America, you know, is probably still being felt today. But they're inspiring words nonetheless.
And it has to be pointed out, we can hear your accent. You're a Brit.
You noticed.
We noticed, and we spend half this movie denouncing you and your kind.
It's very funny. I mean, interestingly, I'm a Brit, but I'm half Australian, and my mother is a historian of colonial and imperial history, and I grew up very much hearing about the colonial experiences that affected Australians, and I also grew up with a mother who constantly told me how terrible England was, and I'd be better off on a country 12,000 miles away. So somewhere in my DNA, I think I'm an outsider. But also, I think as the story shows, I mean, when the film starts, these people saw themselves as Englishmen fighting for their rights as natural-born Englishmen. I mean, the most astonishing thing about it, and the thing it almost took me longest to work out, and David was very helpful on this, is that when the war started, this was a war about rights. It was not a war about independence. The idea of independence was so revolutionary. It was 6 months into the war before it became about separation. And in fact, when John Adams wrote down the phrase, a declaration of independency, in January 76, 6 months into the war, it was only the second time in history that that phrase had been committed to paper. So actually, my Englishness perhaps opened me up to that commonality of all English people at that time. And what's so fascinating about the series is American identity is almost forged during the series, but at the beginning, you know, they see themselves as Englishmen. And it's very easy, Neil, to misinterpret words. I mean, when you read the phrase, the Sons of Liberty, you assume that in the 1770s in Boston, liberty means independence. It doesn't. It's talking about rights.
Tom Hooper, the director of the HBO miniseries John Adams. When we return, David McCullough will join us. He wrote the Pulitzer Prize-winning biography the miniseries is based on. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Cownan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Cownan in Washington. John Adams' image isn't nearly as well known as others of our founding fathers. You won't find his face on any of the coins in your pocket or the bills in your wallet. In the last couple of weeks, however, the image has become more familiar. HBO's seven-part miniseries John Adams chronicles the life of our second president as well as the early history of the United States. We're talking with Tom Hooper this hour. He directed the series, and the final episode airs this coming Sunday on HBO. The series is based on historian David McCullough's Pulitzer Prize-winning biography, and David McCullough joins us now from his home in Maine. David, nice to have you back on the program.
Thank you very much.
Hi, David.
Hi, Tom. I thought what you said was right on the nose, and I would like to point out that I think it was fortuitous that Tom is an Englishman, and that he brought to the production of the film that kind of perspective on history and a balance of understanding that sometimes we, in our affection for our own country in our own ways, don't always have. And I think, too, that it might be added that many times people think that they're hearing English accents on the parts of American protagonists in the film. And it's very difficult to know exactly how we Americans spoke then, since there are no recorded voices from that time. All we really can do is judge from the way they spelled words, since there were no rules of spelling then. But probably they all spoke in a way that would sound to us, does sound to us, much more like a present-day English accent. And, of course, there were many Irish, many Scotch, Germans, all kinds of people here. It was a melting pot then, too, less than it would become in time, of course. But I feel very strongly that the film is a marvelous accomplishment, in part because of the phenomenal attention to the details of that give authenticity to a film, sets, costumes, props, and all of that.
And dentistry. Let's not leave out dentistry.
And makeup, absolutely. But I think what ought to be pointed out and commended in the highest way is that the vocabulary is authentic. There is never a point at any place in all of those hours where anyone speaks lines, delivers soliloquies or the like, in which a 20th or 20th century expression or word turns up. There's no sort of winking at the audience with some vernacular that we hear every day now. Mm. And when we were listening just a while ago to Paul Giamatti deliver that speech, you can tell from that he both has been trained as a classic, in the classic way as an actor, and delivers those lines almost the way one might deliver Shakespeare. But he delivers them with an understanding of the meaning of the words. This is a very elevated dialogue in that film, and I'm very, very pleased about that, because that is the way they spoke. Those are the words they used. That's the vocabulary. And I sometimes hope that maybe some of our present-day public servants and candidates will take note of how once the language was used.
Let's see if we get another caller on the line. This is Diane. Diane with us from Fallon in Nevada.
That's correct.
Go ahead, please.
Well, actually, you touched on both the points I was going to make. One was that the multitude of Brit actors in American roles and how did they feel about denigrating the mother country. And the second one was the dialects that were used that, to my ear at least, sound more Irish than they do English. And what was the research that went behind those?
Tom Hooper?
Our voice coach, Catherine Charlton's, did some great research which actually saw the sort of meeting point of the English accent and the American accent, not necessarily in what we call RP in England, which is received pronunciation, which is sort of the kind of the BBC English, but actually
in vowels.
In regional or rural dialects, so the West Country accents, the Cornish accents, the accents from East Anglia. And I saw some great footage of, you know, a sort of very elderly New England fisherman, you know, recorded in the sort of 1950s, contrasted with farmers in East Anglia in the 1950s in England, and it was quite startling the kind of similarity in the accents, and I think the key is actually in the kind of wonderfully rich regional dialects in England, rather than the classic sort of BBC accent.
And interesting too that Jefferson, for example, and Washington do not speak with Southern accents, and in other contexts we've had researchers on this program talking about regionalisms in the U.S., and they say there was no Southern accent at that time.
Yes, so what the accent differences, Neil, tended to relate to immigration, and there was a tendency for the South to be more populated by the people from the West Country in England, and for the North to be more populated by people from East Anglia. So there's definitely a difference that can be discerned then. But I mean, I think the most important thing is that, you know, we're told, and David said to me, that an Englishman traveling in America and an American traveling in England, that people wouldn't have necessarily spotted the fact that they would from different nationalities at that point.
Diane, thanks very much for the call.
You're welcome.
So long. Let's go now to Jason. Jason calling us from Phoenix in Arizona.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead.
My question was just the whole scene or the whole episode about when Benjamin Franklin and John Adams were in Paris. The whole episode, I actually felt uncomfortable for John Adams, because he was just in this completely foreign land, and it seemed that Benjamin Franklin wasn't helping the situation any. And I just want to know how it was historical and if there was letters or writings enough that said, yes, he didn't feel very well there. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, Jason. And David McCullough?
Well, we know a great deal about what went on between Franklin and Adams during their time in Paris because each of them wrote about it extensively. And they were often airing their grievances privately to somebody close to them in the family or a friend. But they also put things down in diaries and so forth. And there's a tendency to over-stress how difficult the relations between the two of them were. But in fact, they were proving to be quite effective and were working together every day. Now, the principal problem with Adams and Franklin was not just a matter of two different personalities. It was that one was sure that the only way to keep the French involved was to be very obliging and complimentary and to be as diplomatic as possible. And Adams was intensely concerned about those people who are back here fighting the war. And he'd seen the bloodshed. He had experienced the loss of people that he knew. And he was determined to get that French commitment, particularly of the French Navy, as fast as possible. In a way, they were kind of working a good cop, bad cop routine. And as it turns out, and I think the film makes clear, it was because Adams kept pressing for a full commitment of the French Navy that the French Navy was there at Yorktown exactly at the right moment, which made the surrender of Cornwallis to the armies of both Rochambeau and Washington.
And interestingly,
in
the long history of fleet actions between the French and English navies, the only time the French won.
That's right.
One time. Interesting. Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Anne. Anne with us from Denver, Colorado.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. First of all, I love the series and I love the book. But I have a question about the way in the movie that John Adams is portrayed with his children. Because when I read the book, I got the feeling that he loved his children, had a much softer approach, and it just seems the movie, he comes off much harder. Am I missing something, or is there a reason that it's different?
Or at least with one of his children. Again, David McCullough?
Yeah, that's true.
Well, Tom and I have talked about this before, and I feel that the movie makes the point of the father's difficulty with Charles more of an issue than we have any evidence that it was. I know that John Adams was very fond of all of his children. He understandably was excited about the brilliance of John Quincy and saw him as the precocious gift to the country and to humanity that he was, and gave him more attention consequently. But a movie is different from a work of biography. A movie has to do certain things which are essential to making it a drama. Mm-hmm. This isn't an exact playback of my book or any book. And I think it's terribly important for people to understand that these are two different mediums, two different art forms, with a similar melody being played by two different instruments, if you will. Mm-hmm. And I feel that the dramatization of the life of the Adamses, as well as the unfolding story of the war and of the revolution, has been as powerfully portrayed in this film as it's ever been done, and its impact on the country, coming particularly at this time, I think, is of the utmost importance.
Particularly for Tom Hooper, John Adams was not the only lawyer, in reality, for the British soldiers involved in the Boston Massacre. And obviously, one of the things you have to do in a film is reduce the number of characters.
Yes, and I mean, also the trial of Captain Preston was actually separate from the trial of the soldiers. But I don't think anyone in the end would thank you if the story, you know, ended up taking 26 hours and got kind of very mired in detail and sort of boring to watch. I mean, almost, you know, one's first priority is to bring history to life in a way that holds the viewer. And one of the things I'm sort of most proud of is, for example, on the opening night at HBO, when we showed the first two films, over the 2.5 hours of the show, it not only held the audience, it built the audience. And so there's always a trade-off, a difficult trade-off between historical accuracy and the dictates of drama. But please let it be known that these are discussed endlessly, and they are matters of incredible kind of sometimes pain and self-examination, because we all of us on the show, particularly, you know, Tom Hanks, cared deeply about historical authenticity. In answer to the caller's interesting point about Adams as a father, I think, you know, if we'd only shown John being a very loving and benign and affectionate father within the constraints of the time we had, what happens to Charles may have actually thrown people out of the drama, because people may have found it hard to understand. And I do think there's something very powerful in the sixth episode, where we see the dual challenges of leadership, political leadership, and leadership as a father. And he's one of the sort of the joys of the story dramatically he seems to be under as much pressure in his home life as he is as a leader. And so the way we built to that moment was very important to me.
Well, I would like to point out too that I was asked to give my opinions, to be present at the shooting of scenes, went over the scripts in the various forms from the very beginning over the 3+ years that it took to produce the series. And I felt very complimented, and I felt a wholehearted commitment to playing the best role I could to help make this film as strong as possible. And the integrity of Tom Hooper and Tom Hanks could not be greater, and it was a privilege to work with them.
Thanks very much for the call, Anne.
Thank you very much.
We're talking with biographer David McCullough and Tom Hooper, the director of HBO's 7-part miniseries, John Adams. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get Steve on the line. Steve calling us from San Antonio in Texas.
Hi, I'd just like the opinion of Mr. McCullough on this question. I was wondering, what do you think, sir, what do you think John Adams would have to say about the state of our country today? We've lost a lot of liberties as citizens through the Patriot Act and loss of habeas corpus, and I was just wondering what is your opinion on what John Adams would have to say about the state of the nation right now? And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, Steve, thanks for the call.
Well, it would take me a very long time to answer that question, but in brief, I would say that he would understand perfectly that we're going through a difficult time, but he would probably remind us that we have been through much more difficult times in years past, including the time in which he lived. And he would probably emphasize once again, what he believed so strongly, and that was we must be a government of laws and not of men.
Yet he was also involved very much in the passage of the Alien and Sedition Acts.
Yes, he was, but that was a very, very minor infraction compared to other such decisions made by presidents who came later, like Lincoln during the Civil War and Woodrow Wilson during World War I, Franklin Roosevelt in World War II, where thousands of Americans of Japanese descent were put into camps. And these things happen often in times of crisis. I think what's important to remember is not that they were necessarily the right thing to have done, but that when the crisis has passed thus far in our story as a nation, we have always gone back to the way it was before. We have always return to our better angels, as Lincoln would say.
And interesting, as you think about Adams' life. Well, we just have a few seconds left with you, David McCullough. But clearly, he emerged at the time, to his great disappointment, I think, of intense partisanship in the country.
Well, he did, but I think that what came through in episode 6 this last Sunday was the fact that here was a man who sacrificed his political career and political reputation in order to keep us out of a war with France at a time when that would have been a devastating, a catastrophic mistake. And that he really did believe that it is the duty of those in positions of responsibility to think about the good, the welfare, the future of the nation, not of the party.
David McCullough, thanks very much for being with us today. We appreciate it, and we'll let you get back to your retreat there in Maine.
Thank you.
David McCullough.
Hello, David.
And he, of course, was the author of the biography, John Adams, the basis for the HBO miniseries, John Adams. Tom Hooper, the director, will stay with us. We'll take more of your calls when we come back from a short break, so stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today we're talking with Tom Hooper, director of the HBO miniseries John Adams. It's based on historian David McCullough's book of the same name. McCullough writes that Adams could be passionate, high-spirited, and affectionate, but also vain, cranky, impetuous, and fiercely stubborn. You can read more about the quirks and complexities of the second president of the United States in an excerpt at our website, npr.org/talk. And Tom Hooper, the book, and again, as you spoke about earlier, the film focus very much on the deeply personal love story between Adams and his wife, Abigail. Here's a scene from the film in which Abigail gives her husband a little friendly counsel before an important summation, the defense of 8 British soldiers accused in the famous Boston Massacre.
John. Vanity.
Vain.
You have overburdened your argument with ostentatious erudition. You do not need to quote great men to show you are one.
My purpose is to show that certain principles are eternal, and that men of great minds have... Why are you laughing? Through the ages, agreed on certain basic principles.
A noble purpose, no doubt. But some of the jury might think that you want to prove the brilliance of the speaker rather than the truth of the case he is arguing.
Well, perhaps in certain passages, a more direct line might be an improvement. Mm.
Paul Giamatti as John Adams, Laura Linney as Abigail Adams, an email from Jane, who writes, if Abigail Adams' portrayal in the miniseries is even remotely accurate, she is my new heroine. And that central moment, the chemistry between those two actors is just terrific, Tom Hooper.
Yes, it's one of the great, and I suppose one of the first great American love stories. And I think what's really interesting about it is the way the relationship explores the cost of distance to love. I mean, when John Adams has to leave Abigail to go to France, not only is he crossing the Atlantic in the middle of winter where the likelihood of death is clear and present, but he's also doing it at a time of war when they could come under attack from the British, and he's going for an indefinite number of years with no ability to, and at a time where letters would take 6 months to get there with no certainty they'd arrive, and they had to be carefully censored. I mean, it's kind of staggering, the stresses that the relationship was put under, and I think the true test of their love was that they, they came through this in such a in such an extraordinary way.
Let's get another caller in. Lisa with us. Lisa calling from Oakland in California.
Hi, I have a question regarding the way this country is formed and the history of slaves and African slaves being brought on the slave trade to this country. How did you come about, considering we haven't seen any Africans with any speaking parts in the movie so far, I'm not sure if the rest of the series would feature any topic regarding slavery or the topic of African slaves. How did you come about to exclude it so far, or how did you come about to deal with that topic?
Actually, the first film, one of the key witness, John Adams's key witness in the trial, is a freed African slave, and it's kind of a rather extraordinary scene where we know that by giving the testimony that he gives, he's going to be clearly under a lot of pressure, and one only can think what might have happened to him as a result of giving testimony against the Sons of Liberty in the trial. I don't think it's correct that we've completely excluded them. I mean, it's a question of point of view, in that the story of John and Abigail is very different from the African American story. But the great thing about them as a couple was they were both vehemently against slavery, and that you can't tell the story of any other founding father who has such a sort of brilliant morality about the slave trade as they have. And so I think in some ways the very fact that we can focus on them now is somehow a testament to the fact that they had such foresight about that. I also think in episode two we look at the compromise, the terrible compromise about slavery, that happened in the writing of the Declaration of Independence. That Jefferson wrote a condemnatory passage about slavery being an abomination, and Franklin is the first to suggest that this is not going to pass with people in the South. And the argument there reminded me a bit about the kind of current arguments about climate change, when Jefferson says, slavery is an abomination, but I agree that neither I nor any man have any immediate solution to the problem. And this idea that it was a terrible thing, but no one knew what they could do about it because the way the money worked in the South was so inextricably linked to it, I think also touches on it. It's a subject worthy of its own film, frankly. And I made sure Laura Abigail Adams made her feelings known about slavery. Again, in the second film, she makes it very clear what her attitude was.
And at the sixth chapter, and thank you, Lisa, in the sixth chapter, we see the slaves constructing the White House. And
which is a shocking image, to think that the sort of symbol of the nation was built by forced enslaved labor. My own feeling is that wherever I could bring it into the story, I desperately wanted to, and I did seize the opportunities that I had.
Let's get Monica on the line. Monica calling us from the Virgin Islands.
Hi. Thanks. Hi. I love the show. You touched on what my question was about, and it's about the lapse of time between written correspondence. I really appreciate how you portray that in the series, especially between John and Abigail. And I wanted to know if you could comment on, give your opinion on how the lapse of time of written correspondence that was weighed so heavily on the country in early development, and the decisions they had to make then versus how we make decisions now when information and correspondence comes, in a blink of an eye.
Yeah, I think one of the things is it means your diplomats are absolutely vital, because, in that period when Franklin and Adams are in France, because there's a six-month time lag on any correspondence, and also there's a limit to what you can say, in some ways your diplomats had to be autonomous. But whereas what happens now is it's possible for power to be organized much more autocratically if it wants to be, because there's instant messaging and instant communications. So I think what it allowed perhaps was more leaders to emerge who had more areas of responsibility, whereas now it's sadly possible to organize things so that everyone is answerable instantly to a centralized authority. And that kind of touches on the age-old American debate between centralized power and power distributed amongst the states.
Thank you, Monica.
Thank you.
And here's an email that touches just on that point from Noel in Harrison, California. I'm wondering about the dichotomy between Jefferson and Adams' individual philosophies regarding centralized government versus states' rights, e.g., do people need external control, or are they inherently good, not needing external control? Was this dichotomy as historically evident, or was it superimposed by the writer?
I think it absolutely. I mean, not only was it historically evident. I mean, one could have made many more hours of material out of that dichotomy. I mean, what's so interesting to me is that Adams' adult life was most of it was spent in Boston, and Boston in the 1770s, as the film shows, was a dangerous, pretty anarchic place. And Adams's sense of man's ability, tendency to fail, or ability to fail, or the dark side of man came from his own personal experience. And it's no surprise that, you know, as a result of witnessing the anarchic tendency of people to each other in Boston, that he wants authoritarian government. He distrusts the rule of the masses. He distrusts the rule of the mob. And then on his part, Jefferson, who grew up in a kind of aristocratic style with servants and slaves, and wasn't in the kind of hurly-burly of city life, he, you know, that gives him the freedom to be an idealist about people's potential and to believe in the perfectibility of people. And that central difference between Jefferson's belief that people are perfectible and Adams's belief that people are, that sort of man is, like, you know, in the biblical sense, kind of fallen and capable of tremendous sin against each other, completely informs their differing political philosophies and leads to, you know, Adams's sort of belief in a strong central government and Jefferson being terribly wary of central control.
Tom Hooper, thank you very much for being with us, and congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you, Neil.
The last, seventh and last episode of John Adams airs on HBO this Sunday, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation, coming to you from NPR News.